Members, we'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 25th. Representative Lagunias moves approval of the minutes from Monday, February 23rd. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have two issues on our agenda for today. The first is the overview of natural gas policy and the history of natural gas in Minnesota. Secondly will be House File 341, Representative Swazinski's bill. House File 341 will be laying over for possible inclusion in a later bill, so I do not anticipate any votes taking place today. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Doherty. I'm responsible for the regulatory and legislative activities for CenterPoint Energy's Minnesota gas operations.
Thank you, Joni Sieg, Director Gas Business Planning and Strategic Planning for Xcel Energy.
Thank you for being here. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, and good afternoon, committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today. Before we get started here too much, I'll let you know this was a collaborative effort between the state's three largest natural gas utilities, CenterPoint Energy, Xcel, the Minnesota Energy Resources Corp. And that's why two of us are here. The third member was going to be here, Mr. Jeff Larson, unfortunately had a death in the family. But I wanted to call out that Merck was also very much a participant in this effort today. So today, as we take a look at what we're going to be taking a look at here for natural gas in Minnesota, we're going to really address five questions for the committee. And what we're going to address are questions such as, what are the high-level properties of natural gas, and what are the benefits of natural gas? Where is natural gas found, and how does it get to Minnesota? What do natural gas supplies look like going forward? How do supplies impact prices? And then finally, the major item that's impacting all our companies here in Minnesota. And talking with Joni, we would certainly ask that this be a dialogue, so we'd encourage you all to ask questions of us as we go along. As we talk about these five questions, you're going to see three main themes all the way through this discussion we're having with you, and they're very important to us. The first theme is safety. The second theme is reliability, and the third theme is about price. And you're going to see that woven all the way through this discussion we have with you today. So if we get started on on this slide, and to get us rolling here, these are rather basic slides, but have a very important message to it. This first slide just talks about the natural gas properties. It's colorless, odorless, and tasteless. But what we do is we add a property called mercaptan to it that gives it the egg smell. All right. Now, it's critically important because I venture to guess most people know what natural gas smells like when they smell a leak, right? You know, for CenterPoint Energy, we have 1,300 employees here in the state. You know, we have this very large distribution system. Think about the ambassadors we have when we have 330,000 customers out there that know what natural gas smells like. They know that they're supposed to get a hold of us once they smell it. So everybody has a stake in safety, and this is an important role for our customers to be ambassadors for that. They may not realize it, but they play an important role in that as well. Turning to the benefits of natural gas, I'm going to work counterclockwise from the top on this. First, for affordability. Today, natural gas, our average customer pays $700 a year for natural gas. And for that, they heat their homes, they heat water, they dry their clothes, they do their cooking. That is a pretty reasonable price. If we took a look at a all-electric home that did the same thing, heated water, heated their home, did clothes drying, all that, those customers would pay about $650 more than they would under natural gas. So natural gas is very affordable today. From an economic development energy standpoint, this issue really pertains to what's happening on the East Coast. There's a large concentration East Coast of fuel oil customers. And those customers, the natural gas industry and utilities are trying to convert them to natural gas because all that oil is imported overseas to get to those customers. And so the extent natural gas can be used to help heat those homes in the upper mid, up in the northeast, it'll help offset imports to the country. Better for the environment. I think it's a generally well-known fact that electric generation by natural gas is about half as the carbon footprint as electric generation than by coal. As far as the delivery process for natural gas, if we take a look at the slide, you'll see one thing that is missing from this slide, and that is generation. That distinguishes natural gas from electricity. We don't generate anything. We get natural gas from the wells. It's collected by a bunch of pipes and goes into the interstate pipeline system. It's delivered to a natural gas utility and ultimately to our customers. Now, I'm going to keep this slide up on the screen for a minute, but if you all want to slip to the next slide, I'll show you a little bit on why that's important in our pricing structure. This next slide shows, and it's fairly representative for all our LDCs here in Minnesota, it shows a revenue dollar. And what you'll see here is about 60% of our revenue dollars for the cost of gas itself. And so for what's on the screen, that covers the commodity itself that comes out of the well, as well as the transportation to get it here on the interstate pipelines. That slice, that 60%, goes up and down every month based on the wholesale price of gas on the open market. That's what we go out and we bid for that gas, and whatever the market's bearing is basically what we purchase it for. The Public Utilities Commission does regulate us on this. They look over our shoulder and make sure that we are doing this purchasing prudently. But if this goes down every month, it flows through our customers every month. We do not make any money on that. We don't mark up the price of the commodity of natural gas. The other parts of that pie chart you're looking at are our costs for meters, people, our main costs, our cost of money. And that is that, if you go back up on the natural gas delivery slide, that's the utility distribution charges. That part is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, and that's regulated in most part by a process called the general rate base. So let's turn to supply for a moment. I suspect most folks may already realize that, but to state the obvious, there are no native natural gas supplies here in Minnesota. The production areas in the United States are in southern United States, Canada, and the western United States. So here, if we take a look at this slide for a moment, and just to give you a little bit, PGC stands for Potential Gas Committee, and they're part of the Purchase Gas Agency of the Colorado School of Mines. So they're well respected, and this is what they do a lot of, is projecting things. And so what this projection shows is how natural gas, potential natural gas, and what this means is this is the technically recoverable gas that is out there but not yet discovered. So the geologists know the rock formations, and so they have a very good idea where natural gas is located. So if you take a look out there is about the natural gas potential, it was fairly flat from 1990 to 2004, but then the shale gas revolution kicked in. And you can see how when shale gas was found, the supply started to grow, and it's all related to the shale gas. The reason that began to happen is because the technology and the economics to recover shale gas really started to kick in. Now, so what we have today is a potential resource of 2,384 TCF of gas. I'm going to help put that in context for you here in a minute, but that's potential. If we add to that potential the actual gas reserves that are tapped today, you get to a total of 2,700 TCF of gas. Now, annually in the United States, we use approximately 25.5 BCF of gas a year. So what does that mean is that we have 100 years of gas supply available to us in the United States. Now, I'll throw out a little tidbit for you might find somewhat interesting. The natural gas that is consumed in the United States, the 25.5 TCF, Minnesota's share of that's about 2%. Now, how did this really impact us here in Minnesota and across the country, this shale gas, the additional supply, it really has come into pricing. If you go back and we take a look at the early 2000s and up to through 2007, natural gas prices were very volatile and very high. And our customers felt the impact of that. Back at that point in time, it was not unusual for our customers to have bills well over $1,000 a year. Today, it's $700 a year.
Just a quick question. These numbers you're showing, are these inflation adjusted, or are they just the spot price?
They're just the...
Thank you.
So not only are our customers saving, but this is an important point that I don't think it won't be lost on all of us, is that if we go back and we take a look before shale gas and had those prices applied to where we are today, Minnesota consumers would pay $2 billion more, and this is just from CenterPoint Energy, would have paid $2 billion more out for natural gas supplies. See, so that's $2 billion that stayed here in Minnesota to be used in other manners. Where is the shale gas? Here are some of the production areas for shale gas. And I think it's easier to take a look at the next slide, which shows the natural gas basins throughout the United States. The lighter colored areas are the traditional areas where natural gas was found, and the darker color areas are the shale gas plays in the United States. One of the very large ones is the Marcellus Shale play out in New York, and that's important because a lot of that gas is being tapped to go up the East Coast, and that frees up gas down in the southern part of the United States to go other ways, including up towards Minnesota, so it frees up price in that manner. I'll also point out for this slide real quick where CenterPoint Energy, and I expect that Joni talked about Xcel, but where others, where we get most of our gas supply. We get most of our gas supply from the Arkansas-Oklahoma area that serves Minnesota. We do get a little bit out of Canada, and we're starting to get some out of the Rockies. The next... This table is a little busy, but that's okay because I won't lose the point. And the point here is that this is the interstate transmission lines throughout the United States. The interstate transmission lines are regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington, D.C. And you can see where they're concentrated in those areas that where natural gas supply is, or production is the heaviest. What happens is gas utilities such as Xcel and CenterPoint and Merck rent space on these pipelines in order to get the gas to Minnesota. And it's that rental cost, in essence, that we pay on those pipelines that rolls through our cost of gas to our consumers. This next slide, and I will take a moment with great pride to point out this is the only slide in this deck that I did myself, and I had my crayons out this morning preparing it. So what it illustrates is the interstate pipelines that come through Minnesota. And so I'm not going to read them off to you. I will point out that the one interstate pipeline that comes through Minnesota, the Alliance Pipeline, does not stop here in Minnesota, and it is not, we do not get natural gas off that pipeline. Here's the reason for that. First off, that pipeline begins up in British Columbia and terminates in Chicago. It delivers dense, wet gas. Now, what that means is out of a gas well, it's not unusual to get methane, which is pure natural gas, is what we deliver here in Minnesota, ethane, propane, butane, those types of things. All right. This pipe was built to take this ethane, butane, down to Chicago where they strip it out. For instance, ethane is used in plastic bags, bottles, PVC pipe. All right. So that's what that pipe does and why it doesn't stop here in Minnesota. All the other pipes are deliver gas to consumers here in Minnesota, and all our LDCs will take gas off of that. Here's the list of the investor-owned gas utilities in Minnesota. They're currently rate-regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. And finally, that we're not the only folks delivering gas to customers in Minnesota. These are the publicly owned gas utilities, primarily all municipal-owned utilities that serve their municipalities in Minnesota with natural gas. So with that, I will turn it over to Joni.
Good afternoon. I'm going to switch gears here a little bit to something that's very near and dear to not only my heart, but the heart of Xcel Energy, and that's the safety around bringing gas to the state of Minnesota. So I think we've all, you know, read the newspapers and know what's going on, but recent events in the gas industry have led to a lot of changes. One of these events pictured in the lower right-hand corner of this slide occurred in San Bruno, California. On September 9th, 2010, at approximately 6 p.m., a 30-inch diameter steel natural gas pipeline owned by Pacific Gas and Electric exploded into flames, leveling 35 homes and killing 8 people. More recently, in 2014, an apartment building in Harlem, New York, exploded at March 12th at 9:30 in the morning. It leveled 2 apartment buildings, killed 8 people, injured 70 others. Both of these events, caused by a failure in a pipeline, along with other events in the industry, have changed the perception of risk, not only by the public, our customers, all of you, our regulators, right? Everybody is concerned about this. This is serious. Clearly, no one wants these type of events to occur, not Xcel Energy, not our regulators, not anybody in this room. No one does. And Xcel Energy and all the other utilities in the state, there's a lot of things that we do as a company to fix things. Right, when a storm rolls through, power lines are down, we're really good at fixing stuff, mobilizing and repairing, and we do it regularly and we do it very well. However, an event like this isn't anything we can fix. There are no do-overs on the natural gas side of the business, and we must live and work to a higher standard. There have been additional laws and regulations passed in the aftermath of these events. And one of the things that the pipeline integrity rules make perfectly crystal clear is that pipeline operators like CenterPoint and Xcel Energy are responsible for the safe operation of their pipes. Xcel Energy hasn't been standing still. There's been a lot going on in the industry, and we've been doing a lot. This graphic depicts Xcel Energy's what we call our wheel of public safety. Xcel Energy firmly believes that is our duty to protect the public around our pipeline infrastructure. No one should be harmed while working, living, or playing around our pipelines. This circular graphic shows how we are working internally on programs such as standardizing processes and procedures and our integrity management programs. We are also working on external programs. We're working with homeowners and construction workers who dig around our buried infrastructure, along with working with fire and police departments to conduct emergency drills should an event like this happen. Lastly, we're always learning. We're learning on ways to improve upon public safety by doing internal quality assurance, quality control audits within our company, as well as benchmarking against others like Xcel or like CenterPoint Energy. One of our internal programs to improve public safety are proactive integrity management programs. Similar to the last slide, that public safety wheel, we have a similar wheel here for our integrity programs that focus on 3 main things. They are, first of all, knowing your assets. We know our assets through pipeline assessments. They help us identify key risks on our pipeline. Secondly, it's our job to understand those risks and threats on our assets. During this stage, we analyze those pipeline assessments. We rank and prioritize those risks, and then we plan and evaluate alternatives to mitigate the risks on our gas system. Lastly, we proactively mitigate those risks. Risks can be mitigated by inspections and monitoring programs, or repairing or replacing poor performing materials on our natural gas mains and services.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you talk about proactive safety, do you test your pipeline? You know, and how do you test the pipeline? And how many miles a year or a day? Or how do you do that? How do you ensure that your pipeline is as safe as it can be?
So a lot of what we do is regulated by the federal government. So a transmission pipeline, for example, Xcel has 100 miles of transmission pipeline in the state of Minnesota. We are required by the feds to inspect those lines at least every 7 years. If we suspect we have a threat or a risk on that anywhere on that 100 miles, the inspection increases. It's more regular. So our preferred method of pipeline inspections is to take what's called a PIG. It's a tool, a robotic that goes in the inside of the tool and or inside of the pipeline. The gas pushes it along. It's a very sophisticated tool. Depending upon the diameter of the pipe, and the tools can be as long as this room. If we're running it down a 30-inch pipe, so we can detect corrosion inside the wall, the thickness. If we have our biggest threat to our system is a contractor's digging into us as they're doing construction work, so we can even detect when that tool runs down the pipe, any kind of dents in the pipe. So those are some of the inspections that we're doing.
Representative Mahoney.
No, that's fine.
I have a question I want to interject before we get to Representative Baker. So that the data that the monitor, the pig as you call it, collects, I'm assuming that's kept, and that's what the next run-through is compared to, so they can tell wear and tear and corrosion?
You're absolutely correct.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. How long is the typical lifespan of a pipeline, 30-inch? Is there a life expectancy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to speak broadly, if I may, but I would say that typically 30 to 40 years is pretty much an appreciable life of those types of assets. Thank you.
Representative Baker?
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a really nice answer, but so 30 or 40 years might be the appreciable life. What's the what is the oldest piece of pipe you've got in the ground, and what is your average length of time before you replace it? I think that would be the question, the way to ask that question.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative, I will try to my best to answer that question. I'm not sure I have those details in my pocket here, but I will give you an example, if I may. I think I've had an opportunity to meet with many of you in your separately here this session, and I've shared with all of you that we have a 16-20-inch pipeline, transmission pipeline, that goes around the greater Minneapolis area. That piece of pipe was built in 1958, and we have determined, based on the types of things that Ms. Zeke has talked about here, that we need to replace that piece of pipe. And so when it was set up in 1958, you know, I hate to mention anything 1958 is old because that's my vintage, but it is old, needs repaired. I suspect that that piece of pipe was depreciated right around the 35, 40-year pipe life. But you know what? There are accounting, and I am not that pure of an accountant with you, but there are mass set accounting for the utilities, deals with adjustments on this and how that occurs. I even need to get an accountant here to share that with you. So that hopefully that gives you a little bit of a flavor of what's out
there. Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, no,
I'm going to give a follow-up to that. You had a general figure of 40 years. I'm assuming there's aspects in a pipeline that wear at a different rate than other aspects of a pipeline. A joint, for instance, a turn.
No welder would make a bad joint.
So noted.
Even if it's 5 pounds.
Mr. Chair, and I would second no welder ever makes a bad weld there. Every asset category has a different depreciable life. All right. Now, there may be, if you take a look at a piece of pipe, and if it has turns in it and depression or couplings on it all, that might be all part of that asset class. Might talk about a 30, 40, whatever the year depreciable life. You may go a higher pressure piece of pipe, though, all that collectively may have a different depreciation life than, let's say, a 2-inch piece of main, plastic main that runs to Eden Prairie, for instance. Okay, so that may have a different depreciable life. It all depends upon the asset class, the age, when it was put in the ground, the technology it was used at the time to put in the ground, all those things factor, how it's being replaced, all that factors into the science of figuring out, what a depreciable life is on a particular asset.
All right, thank you very much. And any other questions, we'll let the director continue with the presentation.
Thank you. I would just like to add to that conversation. So Xcel Energy also has pipelines in the ground and in service today that were put into service prior to 1960. Age alone, though, doesn't mean that it's necessarily bad. We also have pipe types in our system that were put in the early 70s. That PHMSA, the arm of the DOT that regulates us, has indicated that there's a problem with that particular polymer. So it's on our list, even though it's right 1970s, right? The federal government and PHMSA has determined that polymer needs to come out of the ground, that it's unsafe. So age alone is not the only determination or factor that goes in when I talk about the risk ranking and identifying those risks. Age is just one component, right? You really need to benchmark against other utilities. When people have incidents, right, there's investigations. We know what's going on in the industry. So there's a lot of factors. Leak rates are one of them. Incidences, whether it's on the federal register of a known polymer that has a problem. So there's many, many factors that determine replacement.
Okay, thank you for that clarification, Director. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is for Mr. Doherty. I just want to back up really quick before this gets lost. When you first started your presentation, you were talking about the prices of gas being approximately $700 a year. Electric average is about $1,350 roughly. And then you started talking about the industry. Now, I know when it comes to coal power generation, they generally bid their contracts in 5-year segments. So the price is very fixed. It's very stable, and they know how much it's going to cost for the next 5 years. And then you touched on the on your industry in particular. I was just curious, is there a bidding section of time? How often do you bid out for gas, if that's the case?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm going to answer that question in several parts. First, there are contracts that we have that will be for longer term baseload contracts. Now, those contracts may be on everything as far as service goes, may not cover price. Then you have near contracts for daily, up down to daily service on that, because there's a lot of volatility in the natural gas market as far as usage, and we have to cover that wide range of usage. So as far as price goes and how that is handled, we do a lot of modeling, Monte Carlo simulations, to figure out the optimum way to set up your natural gas portfolio, and we will hedge accordingly. As of now, we do not hedge out much more than a year on price, I think that a lot of that has to do with you take a look at the volatility of prices and you say, what's the prudent thing to do? Now, every utility will have a slightly different take on that, but it is not done just by, looking at figuring and doing this. It's done with the statisticians to spend a lot of time on that and gas supply team to spend a lot of time on that to figure out the optimal way to set it up before the heating season occurs based on what you know, so that you have a chance to One is have a reasonable price and yet not allow for these large price spikes and be quite harmful.
Representative Neuberger. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which testifier, but I'm curious how you treat this on your balance sheet so that with this aging infrastructure, especially when you have peaks and valleys in development and you might have lots of new pipe at one time and not a lot at the other, so therefore you get into places where you're really having to do a lot of replacement. How do you treat that on your balance sheet so that you have the cash reserves necessary to do those repairs so that you don't get into a bind where something should be done and yet you wouldn't have the cash to do it unless you had to go to the marketplace?
Director?
Well, I'll try.
I can.
We do 5-year budget cycles, right? So we're really some of the polymers, those 1970, early 1970 polymers that I talked about. So we know where they're at, and we have a longer-term plan so that, you know, it fits into our budget cycle. Now, I will say that, you know, there are instances when we run those tools or those pigs down those lines, sometimes they come back and there's a nasty there, right, that we need to deal with that's not in that budget. But what we do is we try to then risk rank and the riskiest things and try to redo our schedules to work on those highest risk things as well. So it's not only money, right, but it's also resources. So we have a limited amount of welders, for example, to work on these. And this is the welding profession specifically, right, a large need across the whole nation, right. So they're becoming scarce. So it's a balancing act to try to deal with those. So so we can handle them within our current budgets.
Mr. Chair, Director. Representative, I'll build on this just a little bit, and I think that this is the business we're in, you know, and we have an obligation in Minnesota to provide safe and reliable natural gas service, and that's by law. Now, we don't need the law to tell us that, but we have that obligation, all right? And so I think part of the expectation and the responsibility of that is having an organization that has the financial wherewithal to handle this type of thing. If you want the debits and credits, I agree with Joni that most of these assets, age doesn't necessarily the only thing, but the reality of it is most of these assets are fully depreciated, all right? And so these are new capital investments that are funded out of normal corporate means to do that.
Representative Vogel. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, just so you know that after 1 year of day school and 5 years of night school and trying to pass a welding test, I can't. I can't pass your welding test, I'll phrase it that way. And I've never done a weld on a pipeline. So to the members, kind of what that's telling you is that if there's an issue with a pipeline, very unlikely that it's the welder. Especially since I'm not doing it.
We already have that in the minutes, Representative Mahoney. Thank you for the clarification. Please proceed with your presentation, Director.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think this is my final slide here. So historically, Xcel Energy has spent $4 million annually in capital on our integrity management efforts. And with the focus on pipeline safety and integrity management rules, Xcel Energy will be accelerating the renewal of our poor-performing mains and services, which will increase our annual investment from about $4 million a year to up to $20 million a year. The legislation last year approved a rate-making mechanism called the Gas Utility Infrastructure Rider, which provides gas utilities an additional tool in their toolbox to ensure the safety of the public. Xcel Energy implemented this rider mechanism on February 1st of this year, and it is our privilege to provide natural gas to the state of Minnesota in a safe and reliable manner. Thank you.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just want to note that Representative Seltzer carried that bill, and that was actually part of the solar bill that we passed in 2013. And what I think Xcel needs to be commended for is coming forward and being proactive to take care of any safety concerns well in advance of them becoming a problem. It was a really good bill, and it was part of the big package that we passed in 2013, not 2014.
Thank you, Representative Hortman. Director?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In conclusion, I think this is our final slide, and I'll just I won't repeat what as Zeke said, because it all applies to the entire industry. For CenterPoint Energy, this where we find ourselves is that historically we invested $60-70 million a year in the state of Minnesota. Today, and last year and this year, we're investing about $200 million, and we see ourselves investing $140-200 million for the next 10-15 years on dealing with these integrity issues going forward. So, and I think it's important, and I know Xcel's in the same boat here, is we don't want people to think that our system's not safe. It is safe. This is the type of thing that you want to deal with proactively. You want to get after it so you can avoid the types of situations, do everything you can to avoid the situations like San Bruno and Allentown and those types of things. It's a prudent thing to do. So I think that's all we have. We're available for questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we appreciate the stitch-in-time mentality of being proactive about things. We have a question from Representative Eugenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. One of the things you said, or you told us where roughly the natural gas that Minnesotans are now using, where it's coming from, I'd like you to project ahead about 10 years and say, where do you think our natural gas will be coming from?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative. I really don't, as of now, my crystal ball would say I can't vision it that much differently. I think when you take a look where natural gas supplies are in the United States, the geology that's there, I don't think that geology is going to change to Minnesota or Nebraska. That can't happen. The geology kind of dictates where natural gas supplies are. And I think what we see here is there's a new way to tap into what was there with fracking. So I sincerely doubt that there's going to be much change where natural gas is sourced and how it's sourced and where we buy our gas.
Representative Eugenius.
Well, thank you. Well, then, if I could follow, one of the reasons I asked is we read about in the Bakken field they're flaring off a lot of gas, and so that's.
Mr. Chair, thank you for mentioning the Bakkens, and I probably am a little bit remiss on that. I think because I was speaking a little generically where I'm looking to do things. I think the Bakkens certainly may be an opportunity there. And what I do know, and I can't remember the exact status of it, is I think Montana, Dakota is looking to build a pipeline out of the Bakkens to the Fargo area now. But that requires that they have contracts in place, because they're not going to build this piece of pipe if they don't have contracts to pay for things to back it up. So I think there are some interests out there to do that. What's going to require for the Bakken field to develop into that a little bit more is you have to build pipes to get the gas from the well that has to collect it and consolidate it and then build these plants to clean the gas up and to ship it off. So those types of facilities need to be built. The big issue right now is natural gas is the stepchild to the big thing out there, which is oil.
Oil.
Right, right. Now that the oil's kind of down a little bit, the pressure on that simply because of the price and everything, the pressure out there, I think my understanding, and I read this in the Star Tribune yesterday, and a very good article, actually, that talked about the Bakken field, where they're starting to turn attention towards trying to collect that natural gas because there's a profit motive out there for those people that own those wells to do that. Because the estimate is that they're losing $1-2 million a day out there from the flaring that's going on. And so there's now interest to try to find a way to consolidate. What it'll take is those assets to be built around here to consolidate the gas, a pipeline built to get it here, and a need for the gas here for people to acquire and use it here in Minnesota. Some of that deals with operational things, the way your system's developed. You know, we have more, for instance, for us right now, we need more gas in the southern part. That's where we have most of our customers, the southern part of the distribution system. I'm not an engineer, but that's what the engineers talk about. So those types of dam and tanks feed in. I think it's entirely possible that we see some gas here from the Bakken in 10 years. But I think the general dynamics, that will not replace, you know, the system supply we did from other places also entirely.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Mr. Doherty if he can project on exports. I know the Department of State hasn't improved any exports of natural gas, but is that something that you foresee in the future, and what do you think the impact on prices would be?
Actually, Representative Hortman, there have been a couple of LNG export terminals that have been approved, so I want to make sure that there's not.
Mr. Chair, I think we had this argument at an LEC meeting, and I think that the data, the research shows that we aren't exporting right now.
Well, we are not exporting now, but the Department, the State Department has approved exports. So the Cheniere facility down in Louisiana, Cheniere Energy will be exporting by the end of this year or the beginning of next year. But there's no regulatory hurdles to that. It's actually been approved by the government. But it doesn't really matter. Your question, we're not exporting right now. You're right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure we share the idea that it would be nice for us to be supplying Ukraine with natural gas rather than Mr. Putin.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mr. Doherty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I may have learned more about that from this dialogue than I can provide to the committee. I have to admit, I am not an expert on that. The little that I do know is that I seem to recall hearing that there are some LNG facilities being under construction or supposed to be under construction. And I know that there are debates all over the place whether we should be exporting or not. I'm afraid I can't add much more to that dialogue.
To be continued.
Hartman, yep. It's a fascinating source. Yeah, the petrochemical companies and the energy companies on opposite sides of that one, because they obviously don't want to see any exportation because they have the feedstock for their fuel is cheaper than anywhere else on the planet. But those, there's benefits to exporting that, not only domestic job creation, but also geopolitically. So fascinating conversation. And with the Panama Canal being expanded, you can even export more. But anyways, any other questions for members of the committee? Thank you both very much for your testimony. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, or as they say in The Matrix, Mr. Anderson. What was that? What did she say? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Brett Anderson. I'm the CEO of Dick Sanitation, based in Lakeville. And I'm going to talk about some of our successes from a consumer standpoint using CNG and natural gas. Back in 2011, we implemented a station into our facility, spent about $1.2 million in added five CNG power trucks into our fleet. Today, we operate about 16 of them. When we looked at that investment, which is nearly $3 million, we looked at a lot of things, the diesel costs, the instability of diesel costs, and the reliability and stability of natural gas. And I think your previous testifiers talked about this long-term production in America. I think they said 100 years of natural gas available. That's one of the things we looked at. Not that I'm going to be here in 100 years, but that's one of the things that we looked at is stability. At the time when we looked at this investment, diesel costs were approaching $4 a gallon, fluctuating around that number for a long time. At that time, CNG was about 50% of diesel to operate. And even today with the temporary low prices, I say temporary because it's just a blip in the screen, I believe, but even today there's a reasonable return on our investment with the lower diesel cost. Our continued investment into the CNG technology is proof that the economics continue to work and make sense in many ways. The ways that our CNG technology has worked for us. It's increased our opportunities to be more competitive in the marketplace. We've lowered our fuel costs. The CNG costs have been stable over the last 3 years with our fleet. We've reduced our carbon footprint as compared to our diesel trucks by about 21%. you know, we're reducing noise pollution, which is an interesting subject. We've, you know, the neighborhoods that we've served, there's a lot of truck traffic issues, and anytime we can be quieter in the neighborhood, that's a plus for our company. We estimate about a 30% reduction in noise pollution. There's about 30 decibels less than a diesel truck. Another operational benefit to us is reduced maintenance costs in CNG trucks. The complex emission systems in the diesel trucks have made it more difficult to service them. The CNG does not have that technology because it's a cleaner burning fuel. The interesting thing with that I think will relate to a lot of people here, with our 16 CNG trucks, which is a small fleet, we're reducing the carbon footprint of taking about 94 average passenger cars off the road, or the equivalent of planting about 22,000 mature trees. So that's a pretty astounding, and we're just a small player with that, with only 16 trucks. To conclude, we think the CNG is a clean and green fuel. With our CNG trucks, we're reducing the carbon footprint, we're reducing noise and air pollution, and we're going beyond green. CNG is the fuel of the future in our industry. Anything that promotes growth in this area is a benefit to Minnesota, we feel.
Thank you very much for your testimony. A couple of questions for you. Yeah. So, again, I don't think there's much dispute technically in what you said, that it's cheaper fuel source, it's reduced noise pollution, it's reduced air pollution, and substantially lower operating costs. So why isn't every diesel operation with a hub-and-spoke environment where they leave from one place and go back, why isn't everybody doing this?
Well, a good question, Mr. Chair. Since 2011, we were the second CNG station to be implemented into the state. And since then, there's now six online in our industry with about 170 trucks. As far as other industries, trucking industries, local, I think there's more. I think part of the delay was the engine size of the trucks. There was a 320 horsepower engine that was available only up until about a year ago, and now there is a 350 horsepower, I believe it is. It's increased power supply. So I think that was part of the issue of getting this to roll out more globally, was the power supply of the truck engine.
Yeah. Questions from members of the committee? Really? No one has any questions for like this totally awesome news that we can save money and reduce pollution and we keep all the money in America? It's all good. Representative Metza. Representative Matisa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there were a couple other pronunciations. Yeah. Metzel would be fine, too. No, I guess if you want me to ask a question, do we get money in my district for this?
Those are other questions. Representative Gunther.
You know, it's really kind of remarkable. We have two stations in Fairmont, a little town, southern Minnesota, selling compressed natural gas. And my wife runs a transit company, and public transit, and she said that she could save over $1.40 a gallon, equivalent gallon, by using compressed natural gas. Only problem is to convert her buses into using compressed natural gas costs as much as it does to buy a new bus with compressed natural gas engine. So there's no easy way of getting around that.
Representative Horton.
Thank you. My question is for the chair. So which transportation technology are you more excited about, electric cars or natural gas or sanitation vehicles?
Representative Horton, I would say I think that they are both. I am the chair is equally enthusiastic about both. Electric vehicles, I don't, right now, based on the current technology, they really don't work for the heavy amount of horsepower that's needed for heavy trucks, buses, garbage, sanitation, stuff. Electric vehicles just don't work for that. Likewise, I'm not really sure that passenger vehicles converting to natural gas is really the best way, because we have the electric infrastructure already in place, where that's not the case with natural gas. So I think, as with most, there's only one way to solve a problem, but in this case, I think these are both solutions that are good for the American consumer, good for the environment, and definitely good for the economy. And I just I'm familiar with this because I'm a customer and got the opportunity to tour your facility last year, and it's just from a cost certainty standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, there literally are no trade-offs. And very rarely in public policy do we have the opportunity to say that everything about this decision is good financially, environmentally, and socially. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, be remiss if I didn't compliment Dix on this. You know, they've been a long time stalwart of the Lakeville community, and I think one of the reasons that this is happening is because of that commitment and stepping a little farther ahead of others. And it's really a tribute to a small family business that has grown well to stay with things and do things innovatively like this so that they can bring them forward.
So, very cool. Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, just maybe I missed this in the flurry of heated questions here. In my profession, we drive diesel vehicles, and we get up to 400 and sometimes 500,000 miles on them. They drive like it too, but what is the mileage lifespan of one of your units?
Well, the technology is new. We anticipate a longer lifespan than diesel because it's a cleaner burning fuel, and it's a, if you look at the oil on a diesel truck, very black in a short time because of the soot content in the fuel and the exhaust. And we think we're going to get a longer lifespan. Just one example we've done is we've extended our preventative maintenance oil changes out another 150 hours. So we're getting a longer lifespan in our between oil changes with the CNG truck versus diesel. So I don't have an exact answer for you because it's only 3 years into it, but we anticipate a longer lifespan than diesel truck.
Any other questions? Mr. Eliff, we've used a couple of terms today, and I just want to make sure, if you could, for the members of the committee, just explain the difference between CNG and LNG, I'm not sure if everyone on the committee understands those acronyms and how the difference between them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understand the difference. and Mr. Anderson could probably answer it better than I do, but the L in LNG stands for liquefied natural gas. My understanding is that is a natural gas, which is also under high pressure, but also at a very low temperature, and it becomes liquefied, which enables it to be put into those ships that are going to be going out of Louisiana very soon and taken possibly to other continents. CNG is doesn't have that that capability.
Just compressed. Exactly.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson? The compressed natural gas. Our trucks are at about 3,600 PSI when they're full. And I'm not totally familiar with LNG that much, but I know that a lot of LNG trucks are more, or I think that fuel is used for more over the road, I believe. But compressed natural gas seems to be the thing in our industry right now.
Absolutely. Well, seeing no other questions from members of the committee, Mr. Anderson, thanks a lot for coming down. Let's make sure we stay in contact. I'm glad to hear everything's are going well, and I think you're going to see a lot of businesses following what you guys are done. And candidly, I'd waiting for our school districts to get on board, and everyone wants to save money. So,
all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you. Members, we next is House File 341, Representative Szczesinski. Representative Szczesinski.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 341 before the Energy Committee here today.
Representative Szczesinski moves House File 341 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Szczesinski.
I just want to thank the members of this committee for hearing House File 341. House File 341 is a bill that kind of mirrors some legislation that was previously passed in the areas of wind and solar. This bill would exempt new large natural gas-fueled power plants being built in the state of Minnesota for out-of-state customers from having first obtaining a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission. This bill, we do not have a specific project that this bill is in request of, but we do feel that this has a potential of need for potential expansion for growth of jobs within the state so that energy projects are built here right in Minnesota rather than across the border. With that, we can maybe open it up for questions or bring people forth. I have Ben Gerber from the Chamber, Minnesota Chamber, to testify on behalf of the bill. And at any time you have questions, feel free to bring them our way. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gerber. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on energy and labor issues. Well, thank you for being here today, and thank you, Representative Sawazinski, for offering this bill. I think this is an important discussion to have, and it's really about regulatory reform. As Representative Sawazinski said, I, along with a coalition, last year passed a bill that, while this was included in the original bill, it didn't make it through the committee process, exempted wind and solar that was developed by independent power producers. Those are the power producers that are not rate regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and for energy that was meant for export. One of the things that we're seeing, our regulatory system was set up, and it's evolved over the years, but it's still, I believe, doesn't reflect what it should, a 21st century regulatory system to manage our energy needs in this state. And this is one way, I think, that we could start the discussion of reform. You know, interestingly enough, one of the letters that had expressed some concerns talked about, well, if we really want to make Minnesota a more friendly environment for electric infrastructure build, we should promote similar streamlining benefits that can be used to benefit Minnesota residents and businesses to reduce their costs. And I would agree with that. So while some may disagree with this being the right method, I do think that this at least gets the conversation going. And just a quick explanation. So electric utilities, historically, large vertically integrated utilities, and the example of those could be Xcel or Minnesota Power, that have a captive customer base, built and owned all their generation, they own the transmission. That started to change, and now we've seen independent power producers. So we see those include wind developers, solar developers, but also even in the state we have some natural gas plants that are not owned by those vertically integrated utilities. What they do is they sell either directly into the market, but most often they have a power purchase agreement with a utility. And as we see IPPs continue to make up a greater and greater share of the market, I don't think our regulatory system has started to reflect these changes. We think that just as the bill last year was passed, that this is an opportunity for Minnesota to be a leader. We have, while we don't have natural gas in our state, we are in close proximity to a state that is starting to produce more and more natural gas. We heard from some of the testifiers that there's going to be most likely an increase in the capture of natural gas that is currently flared in North Dakota. So what are we going to do with that? And our proximity could be used, what we think, to make Minnesota an exporter of energy. It's something we've talked about. We do this with our wind energy. We haven't done it, I don't believe, yet with our solar, but I know with some of the reforms that were passed, people want to do that. So why not with natural gas? We think that one of the problems with Minnesota's outdated regulatory system, not only does it not match some of our surrounding states, but it puts us at a competitive disadvantage. I mean, there's a reason why a lot of projects, wind, solar, and natural gas, have been developed in North Dakota, South Dakota, and even Iowa, sometimes to serve Minnesota's energy needs. And we'd like to change that. We think this is a step in the right direction. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Representative Sawazinski, did you have any testifiers as part of your presentation?
That's it.
Do you have a preference to take questions on a testifier-by-testifier basis, or do you want to let everyone testify first and then come back to questions?
You know, maybe we could have testifiers come before and then questions. Representative has something that's pressing that they'd like to kind of right on the tip of the tongue, maybe we could take it up at that moment. But if it's a question that can wait, maybe we wait to the end.
Okay. Well, I always want to get an opportunity to as much as possible. So, Mr. Gerber, I assume you'll be around to answer questions.
I will be.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Next on the list is Ms. Overland. All right, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carol Overland. I'm a utility regulatory attorney. I've been doing this now for about 20 years. And I urge you to just say no to House File 341. Why? Well, why do you want it? First, there's a massive glut of electricity. If you look at the reserve margins, if you look at the market, we have a huge glut of electricity here, but we don't need it. But why would anyone want to eliminate a certificate of need? Well, it makes sense if you can't prove up need. If you can't prove up need, then it's easier to build a plant if you don't, you know, there's no need for it. Where would this be sold? Export, it's inherently inefficient. You're using transmission lines. Transmission lines have significant losses. It's a very inefficient way to do that. But the biggest problem is that local governments then would end up, if it's not at the PUC, it would be at local governments. And they're not equipped to deal with permitting something like, say, in the Chisago County, where they were faced with the LS power plant, a 700 to 800 megawatt power plant is very, very large. It would take massive amounts of water. And what local government is equipped to deal with this? What local government has the expertise to deal with it? What local government has the experts that know anything about water supply for that, that know anything about air emissions? How would a local government deal with that? It doesn't work. And, like, for example, too, the Bent Tree Wind Project, that was before Wisconsin need. They needed a power purchase agreement, but they didn't have it. They did have to get a certificate of need at that time. In that project, the county government cut and pasted the application and called that the environmental impact statement. You know, where will local governments get the resources to be able to do that, to be able to handle permitting? Another problem is that most of these gas plants that have been built, and there haven't been that many recently. There was that MMUA one down in Faribault, with Mr. Glenn would remember. There was the, I worked on one too that was a Waseca project. It was a 325 megawatt they were trying to put in the above the gas dome there, and that didn't go forward. But most of these plants that are permitted are exempted from utility personal property taxes. And then what does that mean? When you host a facility like that, you have emergency response, you have to deal with all the, you know, permitting issues, and they usually, utilities will pay a local government, utility personal property tax, and that goes to the county and the city or township, and it goes to the school district. And they wouldn't get that. So how would this be a benefit to anyone other than someone who wants to export natural gas? It would be a private purpose. And, you know, another point is, you know, what is this for? I've noticed, you know, I'm not sure that if you have a power plant proposed, you know, in your area, I don't know. You know, Mr. Chair, you have that nice gas line up and down parallel Highway 3. It could be there. It could be the Masapa project has an outstanding siting permit, and this would allow them to build one there. That's not a very good idea, and I urge you to really think about what this means. You know, I hear a lot now about the, you know, dysfunctional regulatory system, but what's dysfunctional about it? You know, why is this needed? Who is calling for it? And what's the benefit? It would be very difficult for local governments to deal with a project like, you know, a change like this, and I don't see that you're providing anything for them to be able to deal with it. And I also would urge you to delete that subdivision 8 Paren 7 about the wind and solar, because that's just getting going. Nothing's been permitted yet that way. But how are local governments able to deal with that? It doesn't make sense. And I urge you to say no. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list is Ms. Weifel from Missouri River Energy Services. Weifel. I thought so. And on deck is Mr. Evans from Excel. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Elizabeth Weifel, and I am an attorney lobbyist with Flaherty & Hood testifying on behalf of Missouri River Energy Services. MRES is a municipal power agency headquartered in Sioux Falls that provides supplemental power to 24 municipal utilities in Minnesota. And I'm here to express their concern over passage of HF 341. Although it would the This bill seeks to exempt any natural gas generation units that are not owned by utilities from the certificate of need process. While that seems like a good way to spur generation development in Minnesota, we are concerned that it would do so at the jeopardy of Minnesota ratepayers. Currently, if a utility were to build a new natural gas facility, it would have to go through the certificate of need process to determine if there is a need for that plant, which would look at not only current customer demand, but also forecasts for future demand, and also things like what has been achieved by SIP, Conservation Improvement Program, to date and in the future, as well as the impact on the state achieving the statewide greenhouse gas reduction goals under 216H. Additionally, when an IOU or a wholesale customer-owned power provider like Missouri River, they're also required to file integrated resource plans. These resource plans also look in depth at those issues as well as they look at natural gas generation, the need forecasts, CIP achievements, and also how the state plans to meet its statewide greenhouse gas reduction goals, not only in terms of construction of new plants, but also in terms of the utility undertaking long-term contracts for power. We believe that this proposal would allow some generation to circumvent that entire process, which ultimately may make the state compliance with the Clean Power Plan and with 216H more difficult. Although the proposed EPA rules have been out since June of 2014, the final rules have not yet been seen. Once those final rules are out, the state will also be drafting an implementation plan, a state plan that may require even more stringent greenhouse gas reductions on behalf of the utilities. Allowing a non-utility, non-regulated entity the ability to add greenhouse gas increases without the state's authority to require that same merchant plant owner to otherwise offset those greenhouse gas increases puts the state in jeopardy of not meeting its mandated targets under the EPA rules and of not meeting the state targets under 216H. Because the state and the EPA cannot reach out to require the merchant plants to take action to meet state or federal EPA reduction targets, they will turn to the utilities, which are regulated under the Clean Air Act and in 216H. That means utilities could be put in a position in which they will be required to take emission reduction actions and investments to offset the greenhouse gas and emissions of other entities. Ultimately, it's Minnesota ratepayers who would pay the cost of these measures. Whether you like it or not, the Clean Power Act is a significant game changer, and Minnesota needs to make sure that all of its laws sync up with the final rule and its impacts, and that includes HF 341. Thank you.
Thank you. With regards to the Clean Power Plant rule, 111D is only for existing power plants, not new power plants. So how is it that, what's the concern there that if a new power plant is built, that it would be regulated under 111D?
And I'm betting one of the future testifiers can probably better explain it. But my understanding is with the 111D rules, you know, it sets up a number of different building blocks, and then it's going to be setting up a target for the state in terms of where its greenhouse gas emissions are going to be. And then it's going to be a cap. Once it's met, it's going to be a cap in the future. So, you know, I mean, I guess to explain it real simply, you know, in the future, the state is going to be looking at how are we keeping everything under that cap. And so it's hard to imagine a scenario, especially given the different building blocks of the plan, that the greenhouse gases that are being added, even if they're being added under, 211B, aren't going to count towards the total emissions in the state. And so I just don't think you can draw those lines that easily. Even if it is new generation, it really is as affect that plan. Plus, there is also, again, the 216H. So.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yep.
Next on the list, Mr. Evans, and then Otter Tail will be up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. We certainly understand the argument that the proponent from the Chamber of Commerce made. Eliminating unnecessary regulation is an important thing. We've got a few ideas on that ourselves. And we also understand the need to attract new businesses to the state, and we don't want to be slamming the door on anyone. And so I'm not here really to state any opposition to the bill, but rather to state some concerns that we'd like to continue to work on and discuss as this conversation goes forward. There's really two concerns that I'd like to raise, some of which are related and already been touched on. As you all know, we're moving into a time over the next 5 or 10 years when carbon emissions are going to take front and center in terms of additional regulation and additional requirements. and where the emissions of our current fleet could be affected, could be impacted differently from emissions by new sources, as the chair just referred to. The effect of this change is not known and will only become known after some period of time. And so we need to think about how those rules are going to be implemented. In answer to the chair's question, it is my understanding that while the Rule 111D from EPA is limited to existing sources, apparently the EPA has given the states, including our Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the option to incorporate new sources into the implementation plan. That's a long ways off before that implementation plan is done, and so there's a fair amount of uncertainty about what the impact would be. One of the other concerns that we have that's related to that is, for example, under what circumstances could a regulated utility be required in the future to purchase energy from a gas plant that was built outside of the Certificate of Need process? And would that have an implication on our existing or future fleet of generation in the regulated side of the energy market? Because a plant is built either on spec or with a customer doesn't necessarily mean that at some point, even in the fairly near future, that the excess capacity or even the initial capacity of that plant couldn't be found to be appropriate for an existing utility in spite of resource planning or other factors that we would take into consideration. The second concern that we raised is, as the committee knows, and this is something Mr. Gerber referred to, and I think quite correctly, we exist in a we being
hold
the
on a second. We got to hit a mute button here to see who it is. Okay. It stopped, so everyone can release their mute buttons. And okay, so someone moved their device, so the problem stopped. It seems to be an effective way of stopping that, and we'll continue to do that throughout the committee process. Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The incumbent utilities in Minnesota, as you know, operate under a broad and comprehensive regulation that was largely implemented at a time when we were vertically integrated businesses that operated without any competition. Several pieces of legislation and practices over the last several years, including this one, cause us to find ourselves moving increasingly into an unregulated universe while the regulation that we operate under still exists. And so our hope would be that as we think about the kinds of changes in regulation that would be appropriate for other players, that we also think about what the regulation of the incumbent utilities should be as all of these are taken into consideration. So it's difficult to think about doing this comprehensively, but it also is a little frightening to think about doing it piecemeal as we continue to operate in a highly regulated universe and find that other players are able to come in and operate without that same degree of regulation. So just to repeat, I appreciate the conversation. We think it is an important conversation to have. Appreciate that the bill is here and look forward to talking with you more about it. But we do think there's some other considerations that should be discussed along with the one that's addressed in the bill.
Representative Mahoney, you want to put questions for Representative Bennett or Mr. Evans before we move on?
This is just a quick question. I'm just wondering if Xcel Energy is a member of the Minnesota Chamber.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, we are.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Evans, a previous testifier mentioned, they use the term that we have a glut of electricity, and I don't know if they're referring to the state or the region. Is that something you can elaborate on? Is that a correct statement right now?
Mr. Chair, members, I guess I don't know what constitutes a glut. We have some concern, frankly, as we move into some of the newer technologies. I think everybody's aware of things like, the community solar program, which is going to bring a significant amount of energy onto our system. Frankly, we have discussions with the Public Utilities Commission, agreement with the Public Utilities Commission or with the other interveners about what the need is going to be. The PUC recently ordered us to purchase energy generated by the Calpine plant here in Minnesota, also ordered us to develop our own gas resources at Black Dog, and has ordered us to start negotiations on about 287 megawatts of solar, which would be in addition to whatever comes in through the community solar gardens. So I'm not sure that we necessarily have a glut, but we certainly have a lot of resources coming online. on our system, some of which we may not believe we need at this time, but you know, that's a matter of dispute. Reasonable minds can differ. So I guess I wouldn't necessarily say we have a glut, but we certainly have a lot of resources coming on and some questions about where the future demand is going to be.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Log Talk, Mr. Lauren, and then Mr. Neeson, you're on deck. And then after that, we'll wrap up with Mr. Miller. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lauren Montag from Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls. And I'd like to thank Representative Sosinski for bringing the bill forward as well. Ideas that are new are always good to discuss and to contemplate for future actions. I'll speak first to EPA's Rule 111D. Mr. Evans is correct. Rule 111D, the state's implementation plan, may indeed include new sources of natural gas generation in the plan. And to the extent that they do, the emissions will be attributed to the state of Minnesota. But even if they weren't in the plan, the emissions will occur in the state of Minnesota. Well, on the other hand, the benefits, that is the megawatt hours, will flow to customers outside the state of Minnesota. The preferred plan, so-called in EPA's 111D Clean Power Plan, forecasts a reduction in coal megawatt hours in Minnesota by coal units of 51%. That's about 11.3 million megawatt hours. So what we're going to do is we're going to convert tons of coal to MCF of natural gas or BCF of natural gas. We estimate that the amount of gas required to displace that amount of coal is equal to roughly three-quarters of all of the residential gas load in the state of Minnesota. So that's a substantial amount of gas that will already be required by the year 2030 to serve existing electric loads. So in addition to that, the locations where you have intersections of high-voltage transmission lines and high-pressure gas are limited in any state, and that is a scarce resource to utilities or merchant generators. So offering an expedited process to the non-regulated merchant generators to compete for those for consumers outside the state of Minnesota, in our opinion, could disadvantage consumers in the state of Minnesota. And finally, the only other comment I'll add, Mr. Evans made some excellent points. I'll invite your attention to a Minnesota Power handout as well in your packets. That's very good. And the last thing I'll mention is I took my undergraduate degree in economics. In macroeconomic theory, you prefer to import commodities and to export finished goods. What we're proposing here is to import a commodity, i.e. natural gas, a considerable amount more, potentially, and to export it to other states. I don't think of electricity as a high value-added product leaving the state of Minnesota. It would be better to keep that electricity in the state of Minnesota and leverage it for the production of other goods and services from the state of Minnesota to other places. So thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I've got to add today.
Thank you very much. Next we have... Yep, go ahead, Representative Mahoney.
I'd just like to ask the same question. Are you a member of the Minnesota Chamber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we are a member of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Mr. Neeson, thank you for your testimony, sir. And Mr. Miller, you're on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Neeson, and I'm a senior policy associate at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nonprofit energy policy advocacy organization with over 20 years of experience supporting practical policies to increase the implementation of energy efficiency and renewable energy resources here in our state. The Certificate of Need Statute, or Section 216B.243, as we've heard, creates an important process ensuring that new large generation resources built here in Minnesota meet a number of criteria. These criteria account for factors like energy demand forecasts, state energy needs, and possible alternatives to the proposed resource. In the 2014 legislative session, Fresh Energy supported adding an exemption to the certificate of need requirement for large wind and solar resources that export their electricity outside the state, as Mr. Gerber mentioned. But these sources are very different from natural gas, we believe. The costs for wind and solar have dropped tremendously in recent years, and the trends show a continued decrease in cost in coming years. Wind and solar provide long-term hedging against volatile fuel cost risk inherent in natural gas and other forms of generation. Wind and solar pose significantly lower health and environmental risks than fossil fuel generation. And importantly, these resources directly meet and advance the state's energy goals, which several of which were passed into statute with strong bipartisan support and signed by a Republican governor in 2007. And finally, wind and solar utilize two of the strongest local energy resources we have here in our state and directly benefit local communities through jobs, taxes, and payments to landowners. So given all these benefits, we believe we should be encouraging the growth of these resources through practical state policies. So while natural gas generation can play a role in our energy system as the electric grid continues to evolve, we believe these new large projects should continue to be subject to the Certificate of Need statute. This will ensure that the criteria currently applied are met, that these new projects play an effective role on the grid, and that our state energy goals are at the forefront of our energy policy decisions. So for these reasons, Fresh Energy, and my colleagues at the Isaac Walton League of America, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and Sierra Club oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you'll be around for questions later as well?
Yes.
And last, we have Mr. Miller. And as Mr. Miller is coming up, are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, then Mr. Miller, you'll be the last one. We'll close the public comment portion after Mr. Miller, and then we'll invite some of the previous testifiers to come back up. So, Mr. Miller, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, my name is Alan Miller, and on this matter, I am speaking for myself only. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. In my opinion, HF 341 is ill-conceived. It's not a good idea to exempt natural gas facilities of the type described from a certificate of need requirement. However, in my opinion, it was also a mistake to exempt wind and solar projects from certificate of need. There seems to be a tendency to exempt whatever happens to be the politically favored source or project category at the time from regulatory scrutiny, and that seems to vary depending on where the political pendulum is hanging and so on. But in fact, every project has its own community impacts, its own characteristics, and every fuel source has its own pros and cons. And the rational thing to do is to allow the regulatory process, environmental review and certificate of need, to go through its steps, and hopefully if that process is working properly, that the merits or lack of merits of a particular project will emerge. So rather than create further exemptions, I would prefer to see the exemptions for wind and solar be rolled back and the regulatory process be allowed to operate. And that's the extent of my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. So this is a fascinating debate because we actually have three positions on your bill, Representative Szczesinski. There's the supporters, there's the opponents who want to maintain the existing exemptions to the certificate of need, and then we have a third category of opponents to your bill who also want to roll back the existing certificates of need. So thank you, Mr. Miller, for your testimony. We appreciate that. So at this point, I think it would be good, Mr. Gerber, if you want to come back up, and then if other members who are available for questions certainly could do that. Maybe we could have Ms. Overland, if you want to come down, because you had mentioned concerns about that. So that would be, and then maybe Mr. Neeson, if you want to come down, because that way that would give us kind of one of each of the three positions on it. And then, I should state as a matter of the record that the chair was the author of the wind and solar exemptions from the Certificate of Need bill. And I just want to clarify my reasons for doing that. It was that the Certificate of Need process, as I understood it, was meant to protect Minnesota ratepayers. And if the protections were put in place to make sure that we did not, utilities did not have an incentive to overbuild for generation that was not needed. So in that case, if this energy is being completely exported to other states, the environmental reviews are still in place. There's still protections still exist. As long as they're under 50 megawatts, there's still local involvement in those decisions. But it would be to, because the certificate of need process doesn't really apply when you're not selling it to Minnesota customers, that was the reason why I supported it. So I guess we'll kind of cue things up here with members' questions. We have Johnson and then Wagenius. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo. One of the things that impressed me, I guess, was Mr. Evans' testimony. We talked about piecemeal and Ms. Overland's testimony. One concern I have, Representative Swedinski, that I don't know how this would work out, but how would local governments, what would be their ability to deal with the complexity of what would seem to be a major electrical generating plant? I was just looking at a certificate of need here by Excel where they talk about emissions and water usage, electrical transmission system overview, distribution system overview, distribution of feeder circuits, feeder circuit overloads. I know the staff at the City of St. Paul has no ability, and I can't imagine some of these smaller municipalities could handle that kind of analysis. So that, to me, seems like it's a major problem.
Mr. Gerber, could you, as part of the answer, kind of address the issue of at what point local decisions are made on electricity generation and how we differentiate those under current law?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think you addressed the issue of these are only large energy facilities, which under statute are over 50 megawatts. I'm not sure why we chose that, but that was Mr. Eloff might know. But that that's what has been the law for the short amount of time, at least I've been around. So I think your question about local governments, they wouldn't need to go through a certificate of need at the local level because there wouldn't be one. That's what this statute is saying. There is still a site permit, so you still have to get an emissions permit from the PCA. So it's not like, I think some of the previous testifiers made it sound like there was going to be no more regulation. That's not the truth at all. There is a lot of regulation that before you can actually turn on the switch to a natural gas combustion turbine or combined cycle, there's a lot that goes into it. This is just one piece of that. And I think what Mr. Chair said, too, is important, that this was initially, and when you look at it among the states, actually states that have deregulated don't have, most of them on the East Coast don't have certificate of needs anymore, because by building your own plant, you take on that risk. Your investors take on that risk. And so we're not saying Minnesota is not a deregulated state. I hope people don't think this is an attempt at deregulation, and that's why people are opposing it. That's not what this is. What this is saying is that if an independent power producer wants to risk their own shareholders' capital and invest in a facility, that they should be able to do that. They're not. There's no need to. There's no need within the state that they're trying to prove. They don't have to worry about the gold plating issue, which is originally was that there was this fear that utilities would overbuild their system. I know we've heard in some of the previous committee hearings that investor-owned utilities earn their rate of return for their shareholders by building things, by building, and then they earn a rate of return on that investment. And so there's not that concern when you have an independent power producer. There's no captive shareholders. And if there are, they're outside of the state of Minnesota. They're outside of the jurisdiction of our Public Utilities Commission. They're not Minnesota citizens. So that's why this passed last year. I think it's unfortunate that that this belief was put forward that there would be no more regulation, that because there's no certificate of need, they don't have to go through anything. I think the other unfortunate circumstance, and we've seen this, it played out in the press, and we heard a lot of comments about this is a different issue, but the certificate of need in energy as well as oil pipelines has become a political process and not what it's intended to be, which is to prove whether there is a need for Minnesota ratepayers. We've seen it, play out that it's about fighting over what we should or should not allow in Minnesota. That's not the intent. We're trying to correct the intent.
Okay. So hold on. We're going to go to Mr. Johnson, and then we will come back to both you as well as Mr. Nason. Hold on a second. Representative Johnson has it. He has the floor. I'll come back to you. Understand?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just seems to me that good public policy for the state would require some sophisticated analysis of the plant that's going to be going in any given place, and that the local governments wouldn't have the ability to provide the kind of analysis required, from what I can tell.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
I'm missing something.
No, they don't now. This is all done at the Public Utilities Commission for these large energy facilities. So it's not taking anything away or requiring now local governments to do something new. That's, you know, I think the other thing that some issues have been discussed about transmission. So there's still a MISO interconnection. That's another layer of that you have to apply for an interconnection. You have to go through a whole study about how it will impact the system. These are all things that still any facility that is sited here would still need to go through before they could actually put energy onto the system.
Yep, Ms. Overland, you wanted to chime in?
Thank you, I appreciate it.
I wanted to offer your testimony. So.
I'm glad to chime in. Happy to.
We're now in the chiming portion of the committee hearing. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe the chiming portion is somewhere else. But first, there's an important part of Certificate of Need that you're missing. It isn't just about the ratepayers. It's about whether a project is in the public interest. And that goes to Mr. Johnson's, Representative Johnson's questions. You know, the certificate of need, they have to make a determination that a project is in the public interest. And also, where local governments, you know, aren't involved in this, no. For example, natural gas, you can build an 800-megawatt power plant in the state of Minnesota under 216E, which is the Power Plant Siting Act, because there's an exemption for natural gas power plants. And you can go then under the alternative review, and it goes to the local governments. And that was the issue with the LS Power Sunrise River up in Chisago County. They were wanting to go under the local review. And that is a problem. People are not equipped to do that. So I urge you to consider that and consider the public interest. Another thing about certificate of need, now it's not an issue with power plants because they buy the land that they operate on, but the certificate of need is also the trigger for the power of eminent domain. And so I urge you to think about that if you're looking at removing other certificate of need processes, you know, particularly for transmission and, you know, for pipelines. Think about that.
Okay, so before I go to Mr. Neeson, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in just kind of going along that same line, it's my belief that even if the locals are put in place, so if a project would be below 50 megawatts and the locals would have a charge, they have the ability to advocate their portion of their oversight so that they can pass it along to the PUC. So say a project of, you know...
Hold on. Representative Swazinski, keep going.
So say if a project would be under 50 megawatts and the locals would have a jurisdiction, they could either take on that jurisdiction or they could advocate that to the state.
Okay. Mr. Neeson, if you want to come up here now. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Overland. Hold on. We'll get Mr. Neeson up here, and then we'll come back. We're not going to have point-counterpoint here. We have one person talking at a time. Mr. Neeson, welcome to the committee again.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did any members have any questions?
Oh, so with regards to the point that was before us here, air and water permits being handled over 50 megawatts going to the state basis, can you offer some insights or broker a compromise between our two previous testifiers?
I don't know if I can broker, Mr. Chair, I don't know if I can broker a compromise today in this hearing, but just to give context for the, you know, our broad view of where the electric grid is going in this context, our position is not predicated on the fact that we don't see natural gas playing a role as we move forward, but we do see renewables like wind and solar playing a role in that in the state and in the region, but we see the certificate of need process being one way to make sure that new generation like natural gas is meeting our state energy goals that we have in statute.
Gotcha. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is for the author. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. I don't quite know the rules of the game in this committee yet. So, for the author, under our current law, and that's, our current law, 3.8852, it says that Minnesota is transitioning to a renewable energy economy that ends Minnesota's contribution to greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels. That's Minnesota law. And your bill is taking us in the very opposite direction. So what you're proposing will increase greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels. So my question is, why add to the global warming problem?
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius, you know, this bill is theoretical in nature. To say the debate that we need to have when it comes to electrical generation not only needs to address potential environmental concerns, but also the economic ones. When it comes to the economy of base load, when it comes to the economy of an investor-owned utilities, whether it be a cooperatives or even private producers, when we're looking at, you know, our goals for Southwest Minnesota, our goals for Northeast Minnesota, or Southeast Minnesota, or Northwest Minnesota, you know, we have a diverse economy in our state. We have high energy users, high energy consumers, and we also have ratepayers. And I have businesses in my district that have said that we are an outlier when it comes to the costs of electricity, when it comes to high use, and when it comes to jobs in the economy. That's what we're trying to address with this bill. And I understand where you're going with your question, but you know, there is not a specific generation plant that this bill is in defense of or opening up, but this is a conversation that we think we can have here in the state of Minnesota.
And Representative Guineas, before I go back to you, you cited the greenhouse gas goal in statute.
Yep.
And is it your position then that because that is a goal, that is actually a mandate to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from energy sources?
Either way, it doesn't make any difference. It's a goal, it's a goal. And if we have a goal to transition, I'm not going to get into the debate of that.
Okay.
But if it's a goal to transition to renewable energy economy that ends Minnesota's contribution to greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels, then that's the current goal. So then the question is, the author's bill adds to greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. So my question is, why do you want to do that? Basically, why do you want to add greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota? I mean, maybe it's because I come from a different committee here where we've had testimony ad nauseum. No, I won't say ad nauseum. We've had a lot of testimony.
I've been in the Environment Committee. It's ad nauseum, Representative Wagenius.
Okay. I've been on the Energy Committee and...
Representative Wagenius.
We have had an immense amount of testimony from really top-notch scientists, Mark Seeley for one, about the impacts of global warming on Minnesota. I'm not talking about anybody else. I'm talking about on Minnesota. We're going to lose our boreal forests probably in the lifetime of your children. That's just a given. So my question is, why take this step to add to the problem rather than subtract from the problem?
Representative Wagenius, Representative Swazinski answered the question twice, but I want to tell you why I'm concerned about your comments. The reason why I'm concerned is that you are taking a goal in statute and you are using it you're using a goal in statute, and you are making the case for why no new fertilizer plants should be built in Minnesota. You're making the case that there should be no increase at all in greenhouse gas emissions. And while I tend to keep my hands off of goal language in statute, if that's the case, if that goal language is being used as a basis for deciding regulatory policy, then maybe I need to take a different perspective on those statutes right now. Because I view those goals as kind of being harmless. They're not mandates. They're aspirational. And that really doesn't mean much. But if that's the view, that those aspirational goals are actually used as a justification for denying certificates of need or not building pipelines or not investing in energy infrastructure, then maybe I have a different perspective about what that those goals are. So, Representative Swazinski, did you want to respond to Representative Wagenius' question again?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think in my previous comments I did answer Representative Wagenius' question.
Okay. Representative McGinnis, another fault. We do have Mahoney, Clark, Metza, and Simonson, and we're done in 6 minutes. So, Representative McGinnis.
First of all, I didn't say anything about fertilizer or saying that we are going to... we're talking in the context right now of electric energy. That's the context, and that's where we're talking about. We have a goal to reduce greenhouse gases and transition, because it's talking about renewable energy economy, okay? So it's renewable energy, And so I am just asking the question, why, when we're looking at a renewable energy economy, would we want to add to the burden of greenhouse gases when we know they're going to have an impact on our farmers, our forestry industry, terrible impact on our forestry industry. We probably won't even have one anymore. So it's a legitimate question to ask, and the author hasn't answered it yet.
Representative Susinski?
Mr. Chair, members, you know, I think... when we're talking, you're talking about coal, you're talking about CO2 emissions, you're talking about fossil fuels. You know, whether it be the Keystone Pipeline, whether it be Sherco plant in Representative Neuberger's district, you know, we've got an issue when it comes to our ability to compete in the United States and globally. One of our testifiers came up here and talked about how important it is to import things in raw product and export finished product. And that coal, that oil, is going to be used someplace. It's going to be exported, you know, to the Pacific Ocean and floated over and maybe advanced into China or someplace in Southeast Asia for a growing economy, for jobs that will not be created here in Minnesota. And so when we look at, from a global perspective, when it comes to energy use, energy consumption, and also clean energy and greenhouse emissions, we also, you know, in President's... in the clean air section in 11D, it talks about taking into consideration also the cost of those potential cleanups for energy. When it, I think I can it's in June 4th, and it talks about taking into account the cost of achieving such reductions. Well, what are those costs? Well, I am a firm believer that, you know, we talk about, you know, the cost of production, but also the cost of jobs. You know, whether you're a pipe fitter, whether you're a manufacturer. And, you know, those all those things need to be taken into consideration and not just what someone from Washington, D.C. thinks is best for our economy.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm not talking about Washington, D.C. I'm talking about Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney. And
Mr. Chair, I don't want to – it sounded like Representative Wagenius had another question, and I will defer to her unless you want to just cut her off.
If you want me, it's your time. You want me to go back to represent? We have 3 minutes left, Representative Mahoney, so
I'll be very
up to you.
Quick. Ms. Overland kind of alluded to the fact that a plant like this would not pay property taxes, which would not support the schools and the roads and everything else. Is that the intent of this particular type of legislation or this particular type of electrical generation plant, Representative Swazinski?
Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, that's not the intent.
That is not the intent?
Representative Mahoney.
Then... my concern here is a relatively level playing field. And my question to the author of this legislation last year, although it was in the bill that I carried last year at the end of the session, is not a piece that I fully grasp. We did not. We put a limit on many things in this legislation to come back and take a look at. But it sounds like we did not put any kind of time limit on the certificate of need for solar and wind. So they are forever free to create these industries and these power generation systems and then export it, but yet we put that on gas. That doesn't really seem fair. So I guess I'm taking the third position that we should re-regulate all of these things at a certain point. I understand, my guess is that we were trying to give a leg up to solar and wind, but at a certain point, we do need to take those back into the PUC and say, is there a need for this? Is this a valid use of property and time and energy and investment in the state of Minnesota? So that's my take. It's not a question. My end.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I was just trying to understand on line 2.11, where it talks about a regional transmission organization. No matter whether the energy is sold in the state or out of the state, I guess one of the concerns I have is what happens with the impact of the transmission lines. I mean, that is a concern that is part of the certificate of need, I believe. And I'm just trying to understand what this line does to that. Does this remove that from that, or what is the point of talking about the transmission organization?
Mr. Gerber, is that with regards to MISO?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, that refers just to independent power producers and utilities actually sell into MISO, and so that's what MISO's, I believe, the legal definition we settled on, which was appropriate to refer to MISO. So it's just saying the energy is sold directly into the MISO market, and that's what happens.
Representative Clark.
So, Mr. Chairman, are we saying then that those transmission lines, the impact that they might have, are exempted or not?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think what you're asking is it's not applicable to this situation. This doesn't deal with transmission infrastructure. This is just the actual facility. And so to actually get accredited to sell into MISO to the regional transmission, you have to go through a set of studies to make sure there are no impacts. If there are impacts, then you're responsible for paying for the upgrades.
Okay. Representative Simonson, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and really more of a comment than anything, but and not to belabor this point, but I do want to bring attention to the fact that the bill that you carried in the past for wind and solar and exempting them from the certificate of need is far different from the bill that we have before us today in exempting a natural gas power plant from the certificate of need. Not in the fact that they're both exporting outside of the state, but in the fact of the source of the energy. Now, I just will bring you to your attention the letter in your packet from Minnesota Power, which I think makes some excellent points. And, Mr. Chair, I want to agree with you on the point that part of the reason for the certificate of need is to protect Minnesota ratepayers. And I think within the letter, if we actually read it, it lays out some good arguments how tapping into natural gas as a fuel source could have perhaps an indirect impact on ratepayers across Minnesota. So I wanted to just bring that to the attention of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. With that, Representative Szczynski renews his motion to have House File 341 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Szczynski. With
Thank
that,
you,
members,
committee.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much.